MechCast, Wednesday, August 16th, 2017. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, sorry about a little delay in time, but life kind of jumped in the way of some things. But I am very happy to be back here with you. Things are going well for me. I hope things are going well for you as well. Got a lot of Mac news to talk about, as you might imagine. A number of things going on, including we're going to talk about Apple's number one leaker. And you may or may not be surprised, I guess, at who's been leaking all of the information about the upcoming iPhone and HomePod lately. We're going to get into a little bit of AR and Apple glasses, talk a little bit about Apple Watch, 4K, and the Apple television also rounding out the news. And then after that, we're going to dig into Apple Pay. I had discussed some of my experiences with Apple Pay recently and got some great feedback from you, so we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about the new icons in iOS 11. I have a little bit of an opinion on those if you haven't seen them yet. And also talk about, follow up a little bit more on overseas data and travel, you know, taking your phone overseas and how you can maybe save some money. I got a great tip for you there. And something to do with Thunderbolt cables and how they might not all quite be the same. And then a little AppleCare math will finish up the show. So it should be a good one. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast. And that is Away. Simply put, Away is the perfect luggage, and it really is. I'm not just saying that. Let me tell you why. It's a company founded by two friends from New York who wanted to solve their own travel problems. Stuck at the airport with delayed flights, dying phones, and no access to charging, they needed a solution, and they decided to build one. The perfect luggage with a built-in charger. They developed the Away carry-on bag. And then they took things so much further. They asked thousands of people about their issues with travel and luggage and tried to design bags that solved those problems as well, thus designing the perfect set of luggage and selling it direct to you, cutting out the middleman. And that means you get premium lightweight luggage that looks and works great, but at a much lower price. They have 9 colors, 4 different sizes now. That original carry-on, the bigger carry-on, a medium size, the medium, and the large for extended stays. All of the suitcases are made with lightweight premium German polycarbonate, unrivaled in strength and impact resistance. The interior has a patent-pending compression system, so you can squeeze a lot more into the compact bag. So if you're like me and like to have as much in your carry-on as possible, that comes in super handy. There are great 360-degree spinner wheels for smooth gliding through the terminal. Also, they have a TSA-approved combination lock, removable washable laundry bag so you can keep your dirty clothes separate from your clean clothes. This thing is loaded with features, and both sizes of the carry-on bag can charge your USB devices like smartphones, tablets, and a whole lot more. And the carry-on sizes are also completely compliant with all major airlines in terms of the overhead bin space, so you don't have to worry about that. And they sent me a carry-on bag, and I was able to travel with it, and I have to tell you, it was awesome. First of all, it looked amazing. Great looking bag. I ended up gate checking it at one point and was even complimented on the bag. I had never been complimented on my luggage before, so that was kind of a nice feeling. I was a little bit worried when I first got it because the shell was very lightweight and flexible, but it turned out it's incredibly strong, very, very durable, and that slight flex that it has is really good if you're like me and just always need to, especially on the way home, squeeze in a few extra things so it can expand a little bit. But that flexibility actually adds to the strength and durability of it. And plus, all Away luggage, it comes with a lifetime warranty. So if anything breaks, they're going to fix it or replace it for life. So you're covered. You don't need to worry about that. And the compression system was great for organization. I was able to fit way more into my bag than I thought I had that I thought I really could, and I actually had room to spare when I was all done. And of course, the charging came in handy during layover. I didn't have to fight for a spot with all the other people camped out around those charging stations. You know what I'm talking about. You've been to the airport, right? Everybody huddles around the little places where you can get a little juice. You don't have to do that because it's right in your bag. And probably my favorite feature was that laundry bag. It's such a simple thing, but you know, being able to separate and keep my clothes separate that I've already worn from the stuff that I still have yet to wear, that came in really, really handy. So here's the deal. You can go to awaytravel.com/Maccast to see all of their awesome luggage and luggage sets. And when you purchase using the code MACCAST at checkout, you're going to get $20 off a suitcase. So an even better deal from Away. And they ship anywhere in the lower 48 states for free. Plus, you get a 100-day trial with your bag. So you can live with it, you can travel with it. And if at any point you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund, no questions asked. So again, you're totally covered, and it's really a great way to buy luggage. So go to awaytravel.com/MACCAST and use the code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, at checkout and get your Away bag now. And a big thank you to Away for their support of the MACCAST. Remember a couple years ago when Tim Cook said that Apple was going to be doubling down on security? Yeah, well, maybe they did that, but they've got a leaker in their midst, one that is letting all the details out on the iPhone and the HomePod. And guess what it is? It's the HomePod firmware. It's coming from inside Apple. I don't know. It's like leaking like a sieve. If you've been paying attention at all over the last couple weeks, there's a couple key developers. Steve Trotton Smith is one of them. And also his new cohort, Guillermo Rambo. I think it's Guillermo Rambo. And they have been pouring through the HomePod firmware that Apple put out, and they've been discovering a bunch of interesting things, both about the HomePod itself and the iPhone 8. And I wanted to talk about some of those today. So the HomePod, it's looking like is going to be running a full iOS stack, and it has a shell application, according to Trotton Smith, called Soundboard. So that's the thing that's going to kind of launch, is going to be the main app, I guess, that runs the HomePod itself. It does look like it could potentially be capable of running other apps, although at launch it's not looking like it's going to be running anything other than what Apple has on there. He also was able to discover that the little LED matrix screen, or the screen on the top, is an LED matrix, and it has a resolution of 272 by 340 pixels, which I think I read somewhere is exactly the same resolution as the 38 millimeter Apple Watch. I'll have to go back and double check that. He was also able to figure out that it has 1 gigabyte of RAM. And so we've got a few more little details on the HomePod because of the firmware. Now, one other thing that came out about the HomePod this week, Nikkei is reporting that production quantities of the HomePod are expected to be at just about 500,000 units for this entire year. So Apple said we're going to get the HomePod in December. It's not surprising they're not going to get a ton of units out before the end of the year, but 500,000 seems a little low. I think Apple's going to have a pretty high demand for the HomePod, and so I expect this is going to be another product that is going to be highly constrained. So if you're planning on trying to get a HomePod under the tree at Christmas, you better start planning now and get your order in early, just like you would for the iPhone. And speaking of the next iPhone, the HomePod has been leaking even more details about the iPhone 8 than the product itself. The firmware includes numerous references to infrared face detection, something that's being called Pearl ID. We don't know if that's the actual final name or if that's just a code name that Apple's using. And the references were within the biometric kit framework, which is the same one that covers Touch ID. So this looks like sort of confirmation of Apple using at least facial recognition or face identification in a biometric context. So it could be used potentially, as we've been hearing, to replace Touch ID. We're going to talk more on that in a bit, because there's a number of other things pointing to the fact that Touch ID may be on its way out and Pearl ID or Face ID on the way in. In the firmware, they also noticed a number of face detect methods using different orientations, pitch, raw, roll, multiple faces. So it seems to indicate that the facial detection may be able to happen at multiple angles, and there's even some references to partially obscured. So I think, you know, if you're doing 3D facial recognition, you're going to want to be able to recognize someone, say, if they're wearing sunglasses, something like that. You have a face partially covered. And it does look like it's going to use a combination of both images and 3D models of the face. I'm assuming all that data and stuff would be stored in the secure enclave, much in the same way your fingerprints are currently now with Touch ID. And there are Pearl ID references for both the front-facing and rear-facing cameras. So it's not clear if Pearl only relates to facial recognition for biometrics, could also be doing facial recognition for other purposes, because there is that indication that it'll work with multiple faces. It also seems like it may be accessible to third-party apps. And if it's replacing Touch ID, I think that would be very important. Something I hadn't really thought about is if Touch ID goes away completely, I have a number of third-party apps that rely on Touch ID. For example, 1Password, and I love being able to unlock my 1Password with my fingerprint. And hopefully, if Apple gets rid of Touch ID and implements a different technology, developers aren't going to have to get a whole new API and integrate that into their app. I'd hate to think that my Touch ID in my third-party apps is going to break the day that I upgrade to an iPhone 8. I can't imagine that's the case, but you know, who knows? And again, because it can detect multiple faces and things like that, it may also be the same technology that's going to be used to improve some of like the photo features, where it could do face detection and those sorts of things. So looking to be very, very capable in terms of the sensors. And speaking of those sensors, there are references to IR camera sensors. So that seems to confirm a lot of the rumors we'd been hearing about Apple adding infrared and laser detection and things like that to the camera sensors. Now, that other developer, Guillermo Rambo, has also been doing some digging, and he found out that the code name for the iPhone 8, and we're going to talk about that name in a second here too, the code name seems to be D22. There were references in there to that. There were also references to an iPhone 9,9, which is presumed to be the iPhone 7S. So it is expected that we're going to get 3 different models of the iPhone, the brand new design, the iPhone 8, or what most of us are calling the iPhone 8 at this point, the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus, which will retain the same form factor and look of the current iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus, but be updated internals with the new A11 processors and all that sort of thing. Another interesting discovery inside that HomePod firmware was a glyph or a little icon for the D22 device, so the rumored iPhone 8. And that little glyph, that little icon, does show very clearly the little sensor bar tab or notch at the top of the iPhone. The image was buried inside a framework that handles authentication for Apple Pay on the HomePod, and there were also references to a new split status bar. So it's believed that things like the Wi-Fi signal icons or the cellular icons and the battery icons will be split on either side of that new little display notch, or I keep calling it a display notch, the little tab, sensor bar tab or sensor bar notch will kind of split the status bar, and apps and the OS will be able to write data and information into that little area, those little areas on the left and right. Trotton Smith notes he also sees nothing to indicate an ultrasound under display Touch ID, and he concluded that we can, quote, quash that rumor. I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but it is looking like we might not have any sort of Touch ID or fingerprint recognition in the iPhone 8, which is a bummer, I think. I'm going to be really sad if Touch ID goes away. And I'm not thoroughly convinced at this point. Apple's going to have to really do a lot at the keynote to convince me that facial recognition is better, works better, and is more secure or as secure as Touch ID. It's going to be a real interesting keynote this year, folks, if Apple has to kind of explain through that. But he did say there were references to a home indicator, something called a home indicator, which appears to be that virtual home button, and that that home indicator would also be resizable and could, in certain instances, be hidden, which is another really interesting UI thing to think about. We're so used to using that home button constantly to get back to the main screen. What happens when you're in an app that wants to take full advantage of the screen real estate, say a video app or something like that, and you want to get back to the home screen? There's no home button there, so what is the methodology for that? We have been hearing that there possibly may be a tap to wake feature. A double tap on the screen, again, helpful for when there's no home button. So I don't know if that same sort of gesture would work for bringing you back to the main screen, or maybe a simple touch will bring up or, you know, re-expose that virtual home button and you'll be able to tap that again. It's a bummer, again, that it might end up being a double tap situation or a two tap situation to access that virtual home button. But again, it's believed the entire display is going to be one giant screen. So there's going to be different ways you're going to be able to use that. And in a note to investors, Ming-Chi Kuo said that Apple has canceled plans to embed a fingerprint recognition solution under the glass in the iPhone 8. Now, that doesn't rule out the other option, which was being tossed around, that there might be a Touch ID sensor on the back. That rumor is still lingering, but it's really sounding like the ultimate solution Apple may have landed on is purely this facial recognition. And if Apple does get rid of the fingerprint scanner and does not include an under the glass option, there is kind of a worse situation for them, because there's rumors and claims that the Samsung Galaxy Note 9, which should be announced before the iPhone 8, could feature an under the glass fingerprint recognition technology. So, you know, it's been rumored that Apple was having a hard time getting that to work accurate or reliably, and I think accurately, and maybe Samsung's not as worried about that. So we'll have to see. If they do include that kind of technology, it'll be really interesting to see if Samsung was able to pull it off and Apple wasn't. I find that kind of hard to believe, but you know, who knows? I'm still holding hope, just a sliver of hope, that Apple will have the under the glass Touch ID sensor. I really don't want to see Touch ID go away. Few other things that have been found via the firmware. Like I said, that display is going to be massive. Steve Troughton-Smith said the active display area is basically a 3x resolution at 2,436 pixels by 1,125 pixels, a 521 pixel per inch resolution, up from about 401 pixels per inch on the iPhone 7 Plus. The total resolution of the device is 2,800 by 1,242 pixels, and that could account for the rumored function area. If you remember, a number of the early rumors said there was going to be a main screen area and then kind of a function bar area where the home button would live and possibly other kinds of controls. But Steven says he didn't see anything indicating any kind of hints that the iPhone 8's rumored function area existed. It seemed to be just more screen real estate. So Apple may be just simply dividing that up in software. So it's not like a separate screen or a separate space. We talked about the possible tap to wake feature. There were also references related to HEV or H.265 encoding that indicate possible support for 4K video recording at 60 frames per second. I believe currently 4K video recording on the iPhone 7 and 7 Plus is limited to 30 frames a second. So we're getting better video recording, and a lot of that could be due to the new codec moving from H.264 to H.265 support in the next generation of iPhones. And then finally, iOS 11 has something called Smart Cam. I believe this is one that Guillermo Rambo uncovered, and it seems to be related to auto scene recognition that would adjust your camera's settings accordingly depending upon what's in your scene, what's in your shot, and give you the best possible shot. So this is kind of like the different modes on your digital SLR, you know, sports mode or landscape, low light, those sorts of things. And it seems like Apple may be using a combination of the new sensors in the iPhone along with software to make that happen. Oh, and then one other thing along with the facial recognition that seemed to be indicated by the HomePod firmware is a possible option that would mute notification sounds when you were actually looking at the phone. So your phone's going to be able to detect when you're actively looking at the screen and then give you options to not get notification alert sounds while you're looking at it, which is kind of nice. Because, I mean, obviously, if you're interacting with your phone, you're going to see the pop-up, you're going to see the notification come in, and you'll be able to act upon it if you want, and you won't need the sound to alert you to that. I'm hoping that's sort of an option, and it's sounding like that's going to be the case where you can kind of toggle that feature on or off. But needless to say, Apple is getting ready for the launch of the next iPhones. It's expected that we're going to get an event in September. We're not sure of the actual date. According to ET News, they say Samsung Display is getting ready to operate 7 of its next generation OLED lines at full capacity this month to be able to produce enough panels for Apple. They'll be moving from producing about 15,000 panels per month to 105,000 panels per month. And in case you're asking yourself, how does that translate to millions of available iPhones at launch, right? Because we're in August, moving to September, 105,000 panels per month, that's 200,000 panels. What's going on there? Oh, well, they actually get multiple panels, or multiple screens, rather, per OLED panel. But still, at full capacity, they say they can make 130 million 5.8-inch iPhone screens per year. That's the rumored size of the next iPhone, the iPhone 8. But yields are expected to be at least 60%. See, they don't get all usable screens out of that capacity. So I started working the math backward. And if I'm doing my math right, I get approximately 6.5 million screens per month. So we've got about 2 months, saying they started in August with a September launch. My math says that means they could have about 13 million iPhones ready to go at launch at best. And considering rumors of past launch weekend numbers tend to be around, I thought, about 12 million units. That gives you a sense of how supply constrained the new iPhone may be at launch. I really hope my calculations are wrong, but they might not be. They actually could be too high, believe it or not. Analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that Apple is going to offer the iPhone 8 in 3 colors, black, silver, and gold, although in the last couple days, that gold color has started to surface in leaked component parts, and it seems to be more of kind of a copper color. I don't know if you've seen these images. It's reportedly officially called blush gold, and it's kind of a much deeper version of the rose gold, and it's definitely moving, at least from the images and leaked parts we've seen so far, moving into a very copper-like color. I would say it's almost not gold at all. But in all of these leaked new designs and components, it does look like the back panels, the way the iPhone is going to come out is you're going to have that all glass front, kind of a curved metal frame around the sides that's in a matching color and surface, although a little bit shinier than the back panels. And then on the back panels, it looks like it's actually aluminum covered by glass. It had been rumored it was going to just be glass on the front and glass on the back, but everything we're seeing now seems to be some sort of colored material. The assumption is it's aluminum then covered in glass. And as a matter of fact, a German blog claimed that the extra glass on the back cover could add about a tenth of a millimeter of thickness to the new models. So they'll just be slightly wider, slightly taller, and a little bit thicker than the current iPhone 7 model. Although the camera bump, it's being noted, will be thinner. The 8, along with the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus, again, are expected to be announced in September altogether. And Some of the rumors are saying they're all going to have the same launch date. They're not really indicating when, but we're still hearing that the iPhone 8 will be in extremely short supply at launch. And remember my number of, you know, maybe 13 million units? Well, guess what? Ming-Chi Kuo thinks Apple will have just 2 to 4 million units produced this quarter. So if they do launch in this quarter, that's a severe supply constraint. I had warned you in past episodes that I thought it was going to be pretty bad. It is looking bleak, folks, and it's going to be a little bit of a wait. Now, it might not be so bad because Kuo does say he expects production to ramp up very quickly, saying that Apple will reach 45 million to 50 million units by the end of the year. So they should ramp up, you know, right after launch very quickly. Apple is pretty good about playing catch up as they move to the end of the year. But I just have a feeling because demand for this phone, I think, is going to be higher than it has been in years. It's going to be tough to get your hands on the iPhone that you want, especially the model and color and storage size and things like that. When you start factoring all those things in together, it gets pretty tricky. And if you've been through past iPhone launches, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And this one's looking to be one of the worst in terms of supply. So I don't want to get too down on it, but it's going to be interesting, to say the least. A more recent report from the Korea Herald says, based on supply chain, and maybe this is alluding to the fact that it doesn't look like there's going to be a lot of units ready, they claim that Apple is pushing back the launch of the iPhone 8, so not the announcement, but the actual launch of the iPhone 8, to November, and that they would still be keeping with a September launch for the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus. They cite an unfinished design and various technical issues as the reason for the pushback. I'm not putting much stock in this rumor myself. It seems to be the only source that has said Apple is not going to launch these in the September-October timeframe. So, you know, and the Korea Herald in the past has not been, you know, all that accurate. So take it for what it's worth. Tim Cook has always said, don't trust the supply chain. I'm gonna go with Tim on this one. I think, though, again, we're going to see it in September, October, just supply constrained, at least at first. And then on that naming thing that we talked about, the naming speculation is all over the place. I've personally been calling it the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus. But I have never, 7S Plus, rather, I have never been convinced that would be the actual final naming. John Gruber threw out a couple of options, iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, and iPhone 8 Pro, or he said more simply, just iPhone, iPhone Plus, and iPhone Pro. In my opinion, I think the latter one is where Apple may land. It makes the most sense and kind of matches what Apple is doing with their other product lines. So we've got the iPad and the iPad Pro. You've got, you know, the MacBook and the MacBook Pro, iMac and Mac Pro. So it seems to fall in line. And again, I think it's time to move past the number. I thought it was time to move past the number a couple generations ago. And I think I had even thrown out that I thought at some point Apple would just simply call it iPhone. So this may be the year, this may be the time that they go with iPhone, iPhone Plus, and iPhone Pro. I think that's a great way to go. As far as storage sizes go for the iPhone 8, there's rumors that there will be two options for the iPhone 8. I'm going to continue to call it the iPhone 8 until the actual launch day. So let's just stick with that because that's what we've been doing on the MacCast. But they're saying two storage size options, 64 gigabyte and 256 gigabytes, and then the 7S models, 7S, 7S Plus, coming in three different configuration sizes for storage, 32 gigabytes, 128 gigabytes, and 256 gigabytes. For the 7S, 7S Plus models, they're going to stick with the original colors, black, silver, gold, and rose gold. So remember, the iPhone 8 is rumored to be coming in the black, silver, and then this new gold blush or kind of copper color. But that's all the latest and greatest on the iPhone 8 and sort of the leaks coming out of the HomePod. Apple Insider is reporting on a Financial Times piece. They're saying that Apple is continuing to work on a set of AR glasses. We had heard back earlier in the year that these rumors that Apple was working on an actual headset, some sort of thing like a Microsoft HoloLens, that you would actually wear as a set of glasses, and it would either have a display built in with augmented reality information or be integrated with your iPhone. Well, Financial Times had some updates on Apple's AR glasses progress, and they say they, of course, have been reportedly in development for a while. And it seems like there's a lot more questions than answers at this point, at least running through the Financial Times piece. They say Apple is playing with how a final product implementation might work. They're trying to work out where to place cameras and sensors, how to do the screens, and playing around with various combinations of some of these things on the glasses, some of these things on the phone, and they really don't know at this point which direction they are going in. They note Apple is working on a number of different prototype designs, everything from all of the things being on the glasses, so sensors, cameras, screen, but they also have options for the iPhone serving as the screen. And I think I've seen designs where an iPhone would actually slot into a set of glasses, almost kind of like a Google Cardboard sort of thing. I don't know how that continues to be true kind of augmented reality. I guess unless they're displaying a live image with the image overlay right in front of you. But at that point, you're still kind of looking at a screen and not the real world. That seems like it'd be a little bit odd to me. And if they did that, I guess another concern would be pixel density. If you know from some of the early things with VR goggles and a lot of the using your phone as a virtual reality headset, because of the lower resolution, lower refresh rates, it can cause some dizziness and some nausea in some people. So you need to get a pretty high pixel density and a pretty high refresh rate to kind of get past some of those feelings for a lot of people. And that may be something that the iPhone 8 can deliver. Like we said earlier, 525 pixels per inch is the expected pixel density. And if Apple can match on the iPhone the refresh rate of, say, like the iPad Pro, 120 hertz, they may be able to pull that sort of thing off in a set of augmented reality glasses using an iPhone as the display. But the first commercial product might end up being more of a fashion accessory, just a set of glasses with the camera and the sensors, and then you would continue to use your iPhone externally, I think, as the augmented reality display. So think of an accessory like the Apple Watch or Snapchat spectacles that would link up to your iPhone. It could also wind up being this full, you know, set of goggles, glasses sort of thing, a la HoloLens. The only thing we can really be sure about at this point is that Apple is thinking about some sort of hardware to complement their amazing augmented reality technology AR kit. And I am still totally thrilled about ARKit. Even if we don't get a set of glasses or anything else, the things that developers are using with the ARKit technology, and I think we talked about this a couple episodes ago, is just blowing me away. Every week, there's kind of new videos surfacing. And if you haven't seen some of this stuff, just go on YouTube and search for ARKit demo or Apple ARKit, and you are going to be blown away by some of the stuff that pops up. But I don't know, what about you? What do you think about augmented reality? Are you excited about this technology? I really wasn't. Before Apple gave its demo at Worldwide Developer Conference, before I started seeing some of the things developers were doing with ARKit, I wasn't entirely convinced it was going to be a revolutionary technology. At this point, I think it is the most revolutionary technology that Apple has developed in the last 5 years. I think it is going to be a total game changer, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Apple does with this, both on the software side and on the hardware side. Bloomberg is reporting that they believe some models of the third generation Apple Watch will finally have LTE cellular data connectivity. This is something we had heard rumored about for a while. This would basically allow the Apple Watch to operate without any kind of required connectivity to the iPhone. The LTE chips are reportedly going to be supplied by Intel, which is kind of a big win for Intel. And Apple has been moving to Intel cellular chips, both with the iPhone, and now it's looking like maybe the next generation Apple Watch. Of course, one big concern when you're bringing cellular data to something so small has always been battery. This is supposedly why we did not get cellular data connectivity in the Gen 2 Apple Watch. Apple had reportedly wanted to add that feature, but it just didn't work out. The one thing I'm curious about is I'm not entirely sure why it needs to be LTE. I think we talked about this in the past. There is kind of a lower power version of LTE that's a newer part of the specification, I believe. But I often thought, why wouldn't they just go with 3G technology? If the whole point is just to get data to your wrist, they don't need it to be super fast, because watch applications, a lot of the data that's being pulled in is pretty low. You know, they're already doing it over low energy Bluetooth from your iPhone to the Apple Watch. So that's already a pretty slow protocol, and I wouldn't think it would have to be that fast. And it seems like maybe 3G would have lower battery requirements, but that's not the rumor we're hearing. We're hearing that this is going to be LTE. As a matter of fact, the piece says that Apple is in talks with carriers in the US and Europe to support an Apple Watch with LTE at launch, though it may be limited to a sort of subset of the existing iPhone carriers at first. And one of the reasons for that is because it is just going to be LTE technology. So that kind of limits the number of carriers that Apple's going to be able to partner up with, at least at launch. The Wall Street Journal seems to be backing up the Bloomberg report and said that the LTE Apple Watch service would likely be an add-on to your existing cellular data plan, much in the same way it is for the cellular iPads. So another, you know, $20 a month charge to get data for your Apple Watch. Hopefully it's lower again than the iPad, because I think the data throughput and the amount of data you're going to be passing back and forth is going to be a lot smaller. So hopefully it's much more affordable than some of the cellular iPad data plans that get added on. Following the Bloomberg report, John Gruber wrote that he believes LTE will be a, quote, big deal. And he also says he had heard that there could be a change in the form factor, what he called a, quote, all new form factor. He didn't offer any details as to what those form factor changes would be. We've been hearing for a long time that possibly a thinner design. A number of people also have said they'd like to see a round option. But I think that both of these solutions would present even more battery life challenges for Apple. Gruber did come back and later clarify that the source for this rumor, this form factor change rumor, was a, quote, unconfirmed little birdie. So he kind of saying he didn't put a ton of stock in it, but it was just something that he had heard, not from a particularly reliable source. If you want to go to a more reliable source for this, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says he thinks there's not going to be any kind of form factor change. He does say that Apple will have both LTE and non-LTE options with the third generation Apple Watch coming in 38mm and 42mm sizes, so same form factor sizes that we have today. And it would be similar to the iPads, with a cellular option and a non-cellular option at different price points. They believe that it will, again, only have LTE support and no 3G, which will limit those carriers. And it's unclear if the watch will allow LTE voice service. Quo says it's possible it could, but he thinks it would be unlikely, that it would be purely for data. Of course, voice over IP could also technically be done, so that may be a workaround if the carriers aren't going to support voice over the watch via LTE. Apple will supposedly announce the Apple Watch Series 3 alongside new iPhones in September, so we won't have much longer to wait to find out if we do get a new Apple Watch with LTE. And, you know, Apple is doing not too shabby in the wearables market. Strategy Analytics last week noted that Apple's share of the global wearables market is now at 13%. Just behind the Chinese wearable maker Xiaomi and Fitbit. So Apple said in its last quarterly results call that sales of the Apple Watch were up 50% in the June quarter. So Apple Watch selling very well, and Apple may sell a ton more if the insurance company Aetna gets its way. They've reportedly been negotiating with Apple to try and get free or discounted Apple Watches for their members. That's 23 million members, to be exact. So a lot of possible new Apple Watch owners. They actually already have a program at Aetna that gives Apple Watches at no cost to their 50,000 employees and subsidizes the costs for some of their subscribers. They're looking to vastly expand that program in 2018. And the idea is that if their customers have Apple Watches, it will increase their interest in a healthier lifestyle and allow them to do better tracking of diet and exercise, which overall leads to better health, which ultimately would be good for the insurance company. Less visits to the doctor, less issues means less payouts for the insurance company. So they have a vested interest to do it. We don't have a lot of details on how the program is going to ultimately work, but supposedly they're negotiating with Apple at this point. And again, that would be a huge win for Apple Watch in terms of expanding the customer base. It's looking more and more like 4K is going to be coming to Apple TV, and then we probably will get a new Apple TV that will add the 4K video support. Like I said earlier, there's been sort of this developer find the rumors out of the HomePod firmware competition going on between Steve Troughton Smith and Guillerme Rambo. I love the other guy's name, Guillerme Rambo. What a great name. Anyway, he, this time, was using the HomePod firmware to make some predictions about the next generation Apple TV. He found inside the HomePod firmware references strings that seem to indicate an Apple TV with support for 4K video, Dolby Vision, and HDR10. If you remember, there was also a leak a couple weeks ago from iTunes in the UK where a couple people had ordered movies, and it seemed like Apple was prepping 4K and HDR versions of videos in iTunes to be delivered when you make iTunes purchases. So everything seems to be pointing to 4K for the Apple TV. Now, not long after Rambo leaked his information about the Apple TV, Steve Troughton Smith also posted images of a hack inside the iOS simulator that allowed the Apple TV in the simulator to have options for 4K resolutions, including a resolution of 3,840 by 2,160 pixels. So everything seems to be lining up for some new Apple TV hardware that will support 4K video and HDR video, something that I know a number of you have been waiting for. And what are you going to show that on? Well, maybe you're going to pick up a new 4K HDR TV from one of the vendors, Samsung, Mitsubishi TV vendors out there. What about Apple, though? We got some very, very blurry shots from famous Apple leaker, or new Apple leaker, rather, Benjamin Geskin this week, of a supposed 60-inch Apple OLED television. I know, here we go. We've been hearing about rumors of an Apple television, actual Apple television set for a while. And looking at these images, it's very hard to confirm the size. It's basically a large flat panel display in what looks to be a testing lab. It is flat, it is metal, it is very large, and it does seem to have an Apple logo on the back of it, but actually reading the size from that image is a bit difficult. Now, Geskin says it's a 60-inch Apple TV. It does look pretty big, but I imagine it could also be the new Apple Pro display that Apple said it was working on already. It does look to be too large to be that, and I can't imagine Apple's going to do a 60-inch display, but they could do a 30, 32-inch, maybe even 36-inch display in that size and try and sell that to pros. So it could be that. Is it an Apple television? I think that's just a direction Apple is not interested in moving in. There's plenty of 4K, great 4K HDR TVs out in the marketplace right now. Prices are coming down. It's a very competitive space. I'm not sure why Apple would want to get into that. But needless to say, an interesting image of what could be an actual Apple television. And then what are we going to watch if we did have an Apple television? Well, Apple seems to be pushing a lot more into the original content area this week. Things seem to be heating up. I'm not sure how you feel about the current Apple Music shows. I've tried watching both of them. Planet of the Apps didn't really resonate with me. I made it through 3 episodes, but haven't really been back to watch much more. It just wasn't very compelling. But again, I'm not very into things like Shark Tank or just reality TV in general. So maybe it's just not me being in the target market. I also tried the first episode of Carpool Karaoke, which aired last week, and I'm not sure if I'll keep watching it, but it was fun. It was Will Smith and James Corden, and I thought they did a pretty good job. It's only about a little over 20 minutes long, so it's not a huge time investment. And I will probably watch the one with the Game of Thrones stars that Apple previewed this week. So I'm looking forward to that one. But some of the other artists and folks like that, I'm just not that interested in. But ultimately, too, this isn't a slam on that content. I just think I'm not in that target market. And I've heard from some of you that you think you're not in that target market either. I think this is really targeted at a younger generation than I am part of. But what's your take on it? Do you like these shows? Are you interested in these shows? Do you know someone who is? And you know, how do they fit in? They didn't get very good reviews, I have to tell you that. So Apple may have to do a better job in the original content area. And it looks like they are trying to do that. It was announced this week that Apple hired former president and general manager of WGN America and Tribune Studios, Matt Chernus, to head up their worldwide video unit. He is reportedly going to report directly to the former Sony Picture Television presidents, Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich, who joined Apple about a month ago, if you remember that. So Apple is building out a pretty good team for original content and video. Multiple sources have also reported that Apple has set aside a $1 billion budget to procure and produce content over the next year. So that sounds pretty impressive until you compare it to some of Apple's competitors or potential competitors for original streaming content. In 2017, the budgets for Netflix and Amazon were $6 billion and $3.2 billion, respectively. And according to reports, when Apple announced the $1 billion budget, that was about half of what HBO spends on their original content in a year. But, you know, Apple's pretty good at getting pretty good deals. And so, you know, spending about half of what HBO already spends, and HBO has some really impressive content, I think that's not going to be a shabby start. I think Apple is seriously investing in this. $1 billion is certainly nothing to sneeze at. And I think they're smart to kind of start out slow and work their way up to building something. The question I have is, can they pick the right properties? Is it going to be interesting? And probably the biggest concern is that if they do enter the area of building out original streaming content, is that going to be a subscription service that could potentially alienate or compete with folks like Netflix and HBO, Amazon, and you know, a couple of those, Netflix and HBO, Apple enjoys getting a 15% cut of subscription revenues from those entities when customers sign up using Apple's in-app purchase subscription services through, say, like the HBO and Netflix app. So could they lose that? Could they lose apps like Netflix and Amazon? I think probably not. Could it alienate and sort of strain relationships between those companies? Yeah, it could do that a little bit. I guess it it depends on how successful Apple's original streaming content efforts are. But it certainly looks like now at this point that that's a game that Apple is thinking about jumping into. It's not clear if it's going to continue to happen more on the Apple Music side and they're going to produce content for that at first, or if they're going to develop a whole new service and platform that we will be able to subscribe to. But, you know, Apple has been losing revenue in both the TV and movie sales area, according to reports, as people kind of move to more streaming services. This is kind of the same thing that happened with music before Apple launched Apple Music. So I think it's the direction they have to move in because it's the direction that consumers are moving in. As a matter of fact, Apple's share of the movie rental and sales market is down to about 32% from about 50% in 2012. So the times are changing and Apple's going to have to get in on this game sooner or later. Luckily, it seems like they're very serious about getting into it, and we're going to have to wait and see what ultimately develops. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to jump in and get into some of your comments and feedbacks on my comments about Apple Pay and my retail experiences. Just to summarize, in case you missed that episode, I've been having this weird issue where I'm a huge fan of Apple Pay. I love Apple Pay. I love to use it. But recently, a number of the places that I go to, most specifically my local grocery store, which happens to be in Albertsons, I've experienced that Apple Pay used to work and now it's not working. And I'm getting from cashiers saying, oh, Apple Pay doesn't work anymore or it's not working now. And I think sometimes it's technical issues, but I think other times it's retailers actually choosing not to support Apple Pay. And the little bit of salt in the wound that I always get too is they'll turn around and say, oh, Apple Pay doesn't work, but we do take Samsung Pay. And it was baffling to me, and I was a little bit confused by it. So many of you have confirmed that you're having similar experiences to mine, where certain retailers where you previously were able to use Apple Pay are now reporting that they're not able to take Apple Pay. And, you know, I think for me, some of the bigger ones like Kroger and Albertsons, national grocery chains, I think it's a change at upper management. For Albertsons, I almost know for certain it was when they kind of had a buyout situation going on. Others of you say, no, everything's been great, and especially outside the United States. Again, this seems to be mostly a U.S. problem at the retail side of things with Apple Pay. Outside the U.S., it's well-supported and works very, very well, but especially in Europe. But you had had contactless payment and things like that for years, so I think it was an easy transition. Here, I think there's issues with the hardware and the software, and these are all things that I just feel Apple needs to kind of be more on top of, or trying to work with more retailers to raise awareness and education about Apple Pay, about how it works. I don't know what steps need to be taken, but it just feels like it's languishing over there. And so I did get some great feedback from a number of you, including this little bit of feedback from Robin, who was having this experience with Apple Pay.
Hey, Adam, this is Robin in Richmond, Virginia, and I'm listening to your latest podcast. I was listening to the part about your rant about the Apple Pay and the retailers, and I had to stop right what I was doing and give you a call because this is exactly a rant that I have. And as a matter of fact, I posted into your forums just recently to see what anybody had to say because I didn't want to bother you with it. Because I didn't know if I was supposed to contact Apple. Do I contact the retailer? Do I contact the bank? But my problem is with Panera Bread. We have several locations here in town, and the one closest to our house we go to a lot, and Apple Pay used to work fine. And then it stopped working. I could scan my debit card, and that would work just fine. But if I tried to use the same card in my phone, then it would be declined. And so we started going to different locations to see what was going on with the Apple Pay. Another one, it worked the first time we were there. When we went back, it quit working. And then one time the cashier said, oh, it works on the other terminal, but it doesn't work on this one. And, of course, he didn't tell me that until, you know, my transaction was done. So we are at our third or fourth location now, and it has been working at this one, but it's so inconsistent and unreliable, I'm just at a loss to understand it. So yay for your rant. Add me to the list. Thanks a lot. Love your podcast. Bye.
Hey, Robin, thank you for sending in that voicemail. I appreciate your comments on this. Yeah, you're experiencing something that I've experienced is a little bit different than the one I was talking about, where it seems like some retailers did support Apple Pay and then have made a conscious choice not to. But you bring up a valid point. This is the experience at retail, right? At the point of sale. Panera's done a pretty good job of supporting Apple Pay, but equipment breaks down and it stops working. And I've been at retailers like that too, where it seems like, okay, I can get that a machine might break, but then you come back the next week and it's still broken, and you come back the week after that and it's still broken, and then eventually the retailer starts telling you, or the sales clerk starts telling you, oh, Apple Pay just doesn't work anymore. And you get frustrated, and you get to the point where it's like, why bother? Why, this is supposed to be better than me taking out my credit card and using that. And if the experience at the register is not better than that, then what's the incentive to use it? Of course, better security, right? That's a great incentive, but most consumers don't feel that. And most consumers, I don't think, are worried that their credit card is so insecure that they're not willing to take it out and stick it in a chip reader or a swipe reader, even though that's become a bigger and bigger attack vector. I had my credit card skimmed at a little terminal for, you know, the self-pay parking. And I jiggle the handle. This one happened to be one of the ones with the slots that goes way in, and they now have these tools where they can insert, using a special tool, deep inside those machines, little scanners and things like that. It got caught by my credit card company. Nothing bad happened. I did have to get a new card issued, and it was a little inconvenient. I would have preferred to have used Apple Pay in that scenario, but it's generally not an option. And I get that these things take a couple years to deploy. The reality, though, is it's been 3 years, and the one point that I want to make, because, and, you know, another thing that several listeners pointed out and have said, Reginald is a listener who sent me a tweet on Twitter. He personally has been having a great experience with Apple Pay, and he thinks Apple is doing better than I think. And I would say maybe my only point is that at the register in the United States, I think they can do a better job. I'm not really complaining about it. It's not meant to be a whine, or I guess it can sometimes sound like a rant, but I'm just being critical of Apple because, you know, adoption outside the U.S. is great. Inside the U.S., Apple has done a phenomenal job onboarding banks and credit card companies. They've worked with them. They've got them all on board. Every week I hear reports of new banks coming on board who are supporting Apple Pay, and it's great that we're getting more cards. Now, all of my cards don't support Apple Pay yet. For example, my business credit card. I don't know if it ever will. I don't know what sort of the lines and the rules are when something will support Apple Pay or not support Apple Pay. But most of my cards do support Apple Pay. Most of the banks here in the United States are supporting Apple Pay. The problem is that I think Apple just needs to spend some time and some money and some effort on the front lines. It's not feeling like they're getting buy-in from the retailers. Now, one thing I want to point out, because I did talk about the fact that a lot of the locations I'm going to, I'm hearing, we support Samsung Pay, but not Apple Pay. And I thought this was an NFC thing, a contactless payment thing, because both the systems work the same when it comes to contactless. If the reader has the little, you know, Michael Johnston from the iOS show calls it the Wi-Fi egg, the little Wi-Fi symbol on it, then it should support contactless payments from any vendor, NFC from any vendor. And in software, I know you can disable it. And I thought, well, they were just disabling Apple Pay and leaving Samsung Pay enabled. Well, it turns out, as a listener pointed out to me, that Samsung Pay actually has another technology built into it, something called magnetic secure transmission. And what this does is, if they get to a terminal and the NFC is not there, it can actually emit a magnetic field to the magnetic stripe reader that is still on the device, on the reader, and it simulates the magnetic stripe that's found on the back of a credit or debit card. So it's actually like just swiping it through the machine. Now, they claim it's more secure than doing a swipe, and I have no information to refute that, but that's probably why at some of these retailers where they've disabled the NFC for whatever reason, you can still use Samsung Pay. So that makes a lot more sense, and thank you to the listener who sent that information in to me. But, you know, really all I'm asking here is that Apple Pay gets more attention from Apple's marketing team and more dollars to work on onboarding and signing up retailers and getting buy-in. A great example of this is it's crazy to me that Apple has a deal for Apple Pay with Target stores, huge chain globally and especially here in the United States. I can use Apple Pay perfectly fine inside the Target app if I want to have something delivered to my house. I can use it online on their website, and it's awesome. But I can't use Apple Pay in a Target retail store. How is that possible, and how have they not been able to get a deal done with Target so that we can use Apple Pay in the store? You know, obviously Target doesn't have a huge aversion to Apple Pay, so what's going on here? And that's where a lot of my confusion comes into play. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's nothing Apple can do. Maybe Apple has tried. But same thing with Walmart or other national grocery store chains, Kroger, Albertsons, Costco. All of these places, these are major retailers, and I think Apple's getting huge pushback from major retailers. My assumption is it has to do with the privacy data. You know, Apple Pay does not give over tracking data and all that information to the retailers, and that's something I appreciate about it. Another reason why I want to use it. It's been out for 3 years now. I think they just need to work a little bit harder in this area. So, yes, I'm being critical of them. Yes, I recognize that these things take time, and adoption of NFC and contactless payments is relatively new here in the United States. But, you know, this is an amazing technology, and I want to see it moving forward. And it just feels like it's stagnating. And I have to say that Apple does have a history in the past of, you know, releasing and bringing out revolutionary new technologies and thinking that they're just going to sort of amorphously take off on their own. And I think with Apple Pay, a lot of it is they were counting on the large penetration of iPhones and consumer demand at the retail side of things to get the job done. And I'm just feeling like that's not working. I talk to managers, I say, why aren't you supporting Apple Pay? And it just falls on deaf ears. So I think we need some help on the Apple side and on the marketing side. And that was the main point I was trying to make. And I'd love to hear more from more of you. If you agree with me, if you disagree with me, what are your experiences? Continue to send in your feedback, your comments, your emails. And we'll continue this conversation on future episodes of the MacCast. All right. Have you guys seen a couple of the new iOS 11 icons that were leaked this week? Can we talk about this? Again, I don't want this to be a rant, but I'm going to share with you my immediate reaction and then sort of some of my thoughts on these icons. So you may not have seen these leaks, but basically a couple of new redesigned icons showed up in the latest beta versions of iOS 11. I think it was iOS 11 beta 5. And there's a redesigned App Store icon and a redesigned iTunes icon. And my immediate reaction on the App Store icon was, what the heck, Apple? It just looks weird, folks. It's I get what it is. It's an abstraction, a kind of simplification of the existing App Store icon, the one with the pencil and the paintbrush and the ruler that are all form an A shape for App Store, the letter A. Basically, they've done away with those specific things and replaced them just with round. The best description I have for them are popsicle stick shaped lines. And they're just these three overlapping popsicle sticks. I joked on Twitter that it looks like, if you know what a popsicle stick bomb is, this is where you weave popsicle sticks or tongue depressors together. You can kind of form this long chain, and then when you pull one stick out, it kind of explodes. They all go in a chain reaction sort of thing. You may have seen some videos of this on YouTube. If not, look it up. It's actually pretty cool. But they kind of look like that. It looks like three popsicle sticks laid on top of each other, and I don't get what it really symbolizes. Some have also said that it looks kind of like a campsite symbol. I've heard that as well, but you kind of get the point. And if you haven't seen it, just, you know, search for iOS 11 App Store icon, and I'm sure it'll pop right up. And I get it. I understand the concept of kind of simplifying it. It can make things look more refined, more elegant. But I also think that there needs to be some context. I think in this instance, Apple is probably thinking, well, we've had the App Store for a long time. Most of our customers are familiar that the blue, you know, icon with the thing that looks like an A is the App Store. So we can kind of just abstract it down to this A shape. You know, but I think it might be taking it a little bit too far, especially for new users to the platform. Apple's constantly gaining new users, and there's just no context that says this thing is an App Store. And by the way, I think the redesigned icon for the iTunes Store might even be worse, because it's just simply now a star inside the purple box. If you remember, it used to be a purple box with a musical note, so at least the musical note kind of indicated iTunes. Now it's just a star, which may actually, I need to compare it to the current icon for iMovie, because historically the star stood for iMovie. So now you've got two icons that both use a star, and they're two different apps, and I'm not sure how purple or star in a purple box translates to iTunes Store. I'm guessing they wanted to get rid of the musical note because the iTunes Store has TV shows and movies along with music, so they maybe wanted to get away from the whole music connotation, but then they still have the iTunes Store name. And yes, you know, I know I'll get used to the change. I know this is not a huge deal. I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill here, but I do, when I see these kinds of changes, get curious about the underlying thought process. You know, too much abstraction in my mind kind of makes things harder to understand. I get simplification and making things easier, but if it's hard to understand, it's going to be harder to use. And to me, that seems counterintuitive to the Apple I know, which is about simplicity, but also about ease of use. And I'm thinking this isn't going to be that much easier to use. And you know, this is really just another example in a number of design changes, I think, that have occurred over the years at Apple, last few years specifically, that kind of baffle me. I think we've talked about on the MacCast here what I call the hidden UI elements that Apple continues to add into its user interfaces, specifically with things like Force Touch. There's all kinds of things that are surfaced in different applications with Force Touch, but it's different in every application. There's kind of no consistency, and you never know when something is able to be force touched and when it isn't. And so you kind of feel like you're just bumbling around looking for things, just hoping that something's going to pop up. And I think, you know, just like gestures, force touch will eventually become kind of ubiquitous. People will understand it. You know, we didn't all know pinch to zoom right away, but now it's a pretty common thing. So over time, a lot of these things will get over them. But, you know, I'm still struggling to remember how to do things like the new split screen in iOS 11. That whole process is really confusing, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, they replaced the pull from the side to pull out another screen, which made a lot of sense to me. Now they have this thing where you have to swipe up and drag an icon from the dock and then kind of put it into place. And the whole method just feels less intuitive to me and more cumbersome. Again, I know I'll get used to it, but was it really broken before? And Apple doesn't seem to have replaced the swipe from the left gesture with anything else, so I don't know why we had to move it or why we had to change it. And plus, you know, using the new split screen feature, you have to have an app already in the dock or have an app that was recently launched in the new 3 app area that's over on the right hand side of the dock before you can even add it to split screen. So that means if I haven't launched the app, I now have to first get out of the app I'm in, find the app that I want to split screen with, launch that app, and then go through the whole split screen process. So adding even more complexity and making it even more cumbersome. And, you know, I'm not trying to complain. It might sound like I am, but I'm just confused by these choices. I kind of don't get it. And I want to understand. I guess I want to understand it. I want to understand how this is making things better, how this is making things easier, because to me it just doesn't feel like it. And maybe it's a typical case of old man on the lawn and being resistant to change, but human beings are resistant to change. So I don't know. What do you think? I mean, a change in an icon seems like it should be a small thing, but I also think that an icon, you know, it's important that it sort of represents and indicates the thing that it's related to. And I'm feeling like these two new icons just aren't doing that. But again, as always, I welcome your thoughts and opinions. Shoot me an email. Give me an audio comment. Maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that we were talking about recently, because we had a listener, I think, call in and ask about this, was using and taking our cell phones overseas when we travel, and how to best afford to be able to do that. You know, roaming charges are crazy, especially when it comes to data. So how do you get data when you're traveling? How do you get phone calls? What's the best way to do that? And I mentioned I don't have much experience with this because I don't travel internationally, but luckily a number of you do, and Richard had some advice that I thought was really great and that could potentially save you some money, and it was something that I hadn't really thought about. So here's what Richard had to say.
Hey, Adam. This is Rich Boffman from Bedford, Mass. I was listening to your recent podcast about data plan options for travel overseas and wanted to share with your listeners what I have used for my last few vacations in Europe. First, I'll say that for a long time, I used the AT&T International plans, but the data has always been expensive, even after they dropped the cost by 80% a few years ago. The simplest current AT&T plan is the International Day Pass at $10 a day. This gives you unlimited data, text, and phone calls to and from the U.S. to all the covered countries, which includes almost all of Europe and many other countries. This sounds good as there are no overage charges, but on a two-week or longer vacation, that runs upward of $150, and that is per device. If you have both a phone and an iPad, or you are a couple or a family with two or more phones and a few iPads, it adds up quickly unless you piggyback your devices on your phone's plan by using a hotspot from the phone. Alternatively, you can buy a 30-day AT&T Passport plan, again for each device, but the biggest Passport plan is 800 megabytes of data for $120, with overages prorated at the same cost. This works out to 15 cents per megabyte, or $150 a gigabyte. With this 30-day Passport, you have unlimited text messages, but unlike the Day Pass, you pay for phone calls at 35 cents a minute. The advantage of these AT&T options is that it allows you to travel with your own phone and number, and it is a relatively seamless experience. The European SIM card option used by one of your listeners had issues making calls, needing to fix his contacts' phone numbers, for example, and requiring people to call him on a European phone number. Again, all these solutions are just for your phone. In the last three trips, I've found a much better solution for me and my wife, and sometimes our daughter, on our vacations, a mobile hotspot device, also known as a MiFi. These are about the size of a credit card and about 3/8 inch thick. They easily fit in a pocket or in a purse. They basically give you a secure, private, mobile Wi-Fi hotspot wherever you go that runs at up to 4G cellular speeds, according to whatever is available in your location. The beauty of this is twofold. It works for up to 10 devices, so your data use is pooled across all your devices, and it is a private Wi-Fi hotspot, so it is much more secure than public Wi-Fi hotspots in hotels and restaurants. We find it is often much faster than public Wi-Fi as well. We've used these devices in Italy, Slovenia, the Czech Republic, Germany, Austria, Hungary, the UK, and France, and have been very happy with the performance and convenience of almost always present Wi-Fi. We occasionally stay in small villages where mobile coverage is weak or non-existent, but then usually nothing works there. Of course, if you separate from your family during the day, only the person with the MiFi on them has the hotspot available. I will also say it provides you with a degree of comfort and convenience, not having to worry about and constantly check your roaming data usage all the time. I turn off roaming on my phone for the trip, except in the rare circumstances where I do not have the MiFi on me or its battery has run out. The company I use is Auto Europe. Their website is at www.sellhire.com/AutoEurope. This service gives you three options for data: 5 gigabytes and up to 7 days use for $60, 10 gigabytes and up to 14 days for $100, or 20 gigabytes and up to 30 days for $170. Note that the time period is a maximum, so if you need lots of data on a one-week trip, you can just get the 20 gigabyte option. If you look at the cost of this service, you can see that with the largest plan, you are paying just under $8 per gigabyte. Compare that with AT&T, which is $150 per gigabyte, 18 times as expensive, and AT&T's plan is per device. The last time I looked at Verizon, its wireless travel plans were similar or even a little higher in cost. On our most recent 16-day trip on the Danube River, we used over 28 gigabytes of data, which is more than we use at home. Since we were posting photos and videos, texting pictures, and reading websites, viewing videos, and streaming music. The overage charge on the 20 gigabyte plan was just $8 per gigabyte. So for that trip, it was about $65. So I had no worries about a giant bill when I got home. The device shows you at all times exactly how much data of the plan you have used right on its screen. You do need to charge it every night, as it will run out of battery during the day in heavy use. That's a reason I bring a mobile external battery on trips. I have a large one that can charge my iPhone 7 Plus 3 or 4 times, and I carry that in my day bag. I should note that the MiFi plans I've used are for Europe. They cover 40 countries. If you are traveling elsewhere, they switch to $8.32 a day for countries in the Caribbean, South America, and Asia, but I think have unlimited data. I'm not sure about that. The service is quite simple to use. You go to their website, pick the data plan you want, enter the countries you are visiting, and your travel dates. They will take your credit card information and ship you the MiFi unit to arrive at your home a few days before your departure date. It comes with a mini USB charger and cord in a carrying case, plus a return envelope with a UPS mailing label. Make sure you do not turn it on until you get off the plane at your first destination overseas, or you will be charged an $8 a day US daily fee. When you return from vacation, pack up the MiFi with the charger in the return envelope and drop it in a UPS drop box. That's it. Overage charges are assessed automatically following your return. Anyway, I hope your listeners find this useful. Keep up the great work with the podcast. I never miss it.
Hey, Richard, thank you so much for sending that in. Yeah, I appreciate the comments and the advice. I don't travel internationally, so I have to rely on you guys to tell me what the best thing to do is. And this sounds like a great option, a great way to go, and can probably save a number of you quite a bit of money. So thank you for sending that in. While we're on the subject of data usage in cell phones and carrier plans, I do have another issue related to data plans, but here domestically in the United States. I think I probably mentioned, I don't remember if it was last episode or the episode before, I told you that I moved recently to one of the new AT&T Unlimited Choice plans. I was having a situation where, you know, every once in a while we would go over our data. I'd pay the monthly data overage charge, and it wasn't that big a deal. This past month, because I had been traveling quite a bit more than I normally do over the summer, I hit a couple of extra overages. And when I called in to kind of ask AT&T about some of my plan overages and things like that, they mentioned that I could get the new unlimited data plan and save $5 off of the current family share plan that I was on. And I asked the rep several times if there were going to be any differences in the plans in terms of my coverages. And the rep reassured me many times that nothing would change. I would have all the same services and the same kind of calling and everything that I would before. So I happily switched, because the net result was I was going to reduce the cost of my monthly bill by about $5 a month. Well, you know, famous last words. Not long after I did the switch, one day I went to go use my Wi-Fi hotspot, and I think you probably know where this is going. It wasn't available. Didn't have Wi-Fi hotspot. So call up AT&T customer service again. Oh yeah, the unlimited choice plan doesn't have hotspot. You need the unlimited, I think they call it the unlimited plus plan, and that plan is $30 more. So now it's going to be $25 more a month than the previous family share plan that I had. And they were more than happy to move me back to my old family share plan, and they gave me that option to do it. But then in researching the AT&T Unlimited Plus plan, some things came out. AT&T Unlimited Plus, because AT&T now is part of or owns DirecTV and has DirecTV Now, that plan comes with not only the hotspot, but also free HBO. And I'm already a HBO Now subscriber. I pay $15 a month for that. So take that off the $25, and now it's going to be just $10 a month more. And I will have unlimited everything, and I'll have my hotspot and all those sorts of things. So where I was going to save $5 a month, it was basically going to cost me a little bit more. But I then have unlimited data on all my family's phones and lines. And yes, I know that there is a data cap, but that data cap per line was at about 23 gigabytes, I think, is where it's capped with AT&T. And we weren't even using that on the total family share plan. So we weren't really at any risk of running up against those limits. So I switched to that. But here's the rub, and here's the thing that I want to bring to you, because I have a question about this. I have been thinking for a while about switching my carrier, because I've been having a number of issues with AT&T and their data speeds over the past year. A lot of places where I used to get LTE, I'm now dropping down to 4G and even slower speeds. And so I have not been happy with their data and voice coverage lately. And then I read the latest data sort of survey reports from OpenSignal, and they say that since AT&T and Verizon have introduced their new unlimited data plans, there has been a marked decline in their 4G speeds on their networks. Basically, they're getting oversaturated. I think they're also signing up way too many new customers. I think more people are moving to smartphones, and they're picking AT&T and Verizon, and they're not keeping up with building out their networks. So I've been generally unhappy with them. In the US, OpenSignal says that T-Mobile has 4G signal about 90.9% of the time in all of the areas that they cover. And again, I'm in a major market. I don't travel too much outside of major markets. So if I look at the coverage maps, they're pretty much the same for all the carriers, AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon. It really doesn't matter. So I've been seriously considering a switch to T-Mobile, and I can get four lines on T-Mobile for, and this is their, I think they call it the T-Mobile One plan, for $160 a month. For AT&T right now, to get unlimited data on all four of those phones under that Plus plan, it is costing me $223 a month with taxes and fees. And so if I make the switch, I'm going to be saving over $500 a year, even once you factor in me having to go back and pay, you know, for HBO Now at $15 a month. So that is just almost, in my opinion, too good a deal to pass up. And I've been talking to a lot of friends and family, people who have switched to AT&T. Michael Johnston over at the iOS show did it recently. He says he's totally happy with T-Mobile. And I've been hearing nothing but great things about their data speeds. And plus, they have that option if you're willing to opt in to get, I think it's DVD quality video streams, your video streaming does not count against your data plan. So I've asked all my friends and family. It's been very positive. Now I want to ask you, have any of you made the switch to T-Mobile, specifically in the United States? And how do you feel about it? How has it been? Are there any horror stories? Are there any gotchas? Any things that I might be missing? But overall, it sounds like I can move, get faster service, the same amount of coverage, and pay a lot less. So why I wouldn't do that, I don't know. But I'll wait to hear back from you. And if I don't in a week or two, I'm probably going to be making the switch. All right, a few other things to talk to you about in this episode. Thunderbolt cables. Let's talk a little bit about Thunderbolt 3, the latest version of Thunderbolt. I'm bringing this up this week because there was a great piece, I'm going to link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, over at Apple Insider, that explains, turns out, not all Thunderbolt or USB-C cables are created equal. One of the big things about Thunderbolt 3 is that it uses the USB-C type connector. So it's kind of one connector that we get. We can do USB-C or Thunderbolt over that connector. We can get power over that connector. If you've heard past MacCasts, you know I am a pretty big fan of this. I know a lot of people are a little miffed about maybe having to use dongles for a while, but I think this idea of switching to a single connector standard on our devices and our notebooks and Macs and desktops is ultimately a great thing. I think it really simplifies things, or at least that was my belief until I read this Apple Insider piece. So it's great that we have a universal type connector, but apparently just having that is not enough, because now we really have to think about the cables and the types of devices we are connecting through that connector. And here's the things, according to Apple Insider, that you're going to have to think about. Will this be used, this thing that I'm connecting, be used as a USB 3.1 device, a USB Type-C 3.1 device, or a Thunderbolt 3 device, or both? What kinds of data speeds do I need through this device that I'm connecting? What is the length of cable that I want to use? And do I need power through this cable? And how much power do I want to get through this cable to my device? Yeah, it gets complicated, folks. Apparently, what's going on is that there are a lot of rules surrounding how you connect different peripherals, whether they're Thunderbolt 3 or USB 3.1, and what this means. So all of this really applies to 2016 and newer Mac models that have Thunderbolt 3 connectors that also support what's called USB 3.1 Generation 2. Again, they're all using the same connector. And I know it gets confusing because the USB-C type connector is that new tiny little USB connector that is kind of round, almost symmetrical. That's just the connector. The USB that runs through that can be a couple of different flavors, the latest generation being USB, what's called USB 3.1 Generation 2. If you have a Mac model with a USB Type-C connector that's older than the 2016 or newer models, like something like the 12-inch MacBook, it has a USB-C connector, but it was limited to USB 3.0 speeds because it's a USB 3.1 Generation 1 connector. With USB 3.1 Generation 2, that's on the newer Macs, that can do data throughput up to 10 gigabits per second. Thunderbolt 3, which also can run, again, through that same USB-C type connector, that runs at up to 40 gigabits per second, again, if you have all of the right cables, because to get the full Thunderbolt 3 speeds, there are some caveats. First, with Thunderbolt 3 devices and cables and connectors, the connector on both sides needs to be a USB Type-C connector. And you also need to be aware that while a Thunderbolt 3 cable can function as a Thunderbolt 3 cable or a USB 3.1 cable, the opposite is not true. So if you have a USB 3.1 cable with the USB Type-C connectors on both ends, but it's not a quote-unquote Thunderbolt cable, it's not going to work for your Thunderbolt devices. See where this is starting to get complicated? So you have to know, not by looking at the connector, not by looking at the cable, you just have to magically know that this is a Thunderbolt 3 cable or this is a USB 3.1 cable. Now, that in and of itself is confusing. You ready to add in another bit of confusion? Power. So another advantage of the USB Type-C connectors and Thunderbolt 3 is that they can carry up to 100 watts of power bidirectionally. But guess what? Yeah. You know where I'm going with this. Not all cables can carry the full amount of power. As a matter of fact, Apple themselves is guilty of this. So when you buy your new MacBook Pro or your new MacBook, it comes with a USB-C dongle and a USB 3.1 cable. With each model, that cable looks the same. But guess what? They are power rated for the specific model of Mac that you have. 27 watts for your MacBook, 60 watts for your 13-inch MacBook Pros, and 87 watts for the 15-inch MacBook Pro. So that's the power rating on the wall wart, but it's also the power rating for your USB 3.1 cable. So you can still mix and match the cables, but the deal is you're only going to get power, the power level rating, for the lowest wattage component in the chain, being either the wall adapter or the cable. So if you have a 27-watt MacBook adapter and you use your 15-inch MacBook Pro 87-watt cable to connect that, you're fine. It's going to charge from the 27-watt wall charger through the 87-watt cable at 27 watts. That makes sense. But if you mess up and do the opposite, you start with an 87-watt adapter, but attach a 27-watt cable and then connect that, say, to your 15-inch MacBook Pro, which can charge at 87 watts, you're only going to get 27 watts because the cable is only allowing 27 watts to come through. And remember, the cable doesn't look any different. So how are you supposed to know? I'm going to advise that you want to label your cables when you get them. Also, oddly, Apple cables are all only able to transfer transfer the USB data at USB 2.0 speeds, which is the 5 gigabits per second. I'm not sure exactly what that's all about, but it was just something that was noted in the Macworld piece. And in case you think the confusion is over, oh no, no, folks, there's one other thing that you need to worry about. Size matters, at least when it comes to Thunderbolt and USB 3.1 cables. Turns out there are two kinds of possible cables: passive cables and active cables. Passive cables tend to be cheaper and also degrade as the length gets longer. So the maximum throughput speed goes down the longer the cable is that you have. Apple Insider notes that passive Thunderbolt 3 cables will actually drop to about 20 gigabits per second at about 2 meters in length. If you have active cables, they have little transceivers in them that regulate the data transfer, and they can maintain speeds of up to 40 gigabits per second, so the full capability of Thunderbolt 3, at a maximum of 2 meters. So if you're going to be connecting Thunderbolt 3 devices with a Thunderbolt 3 cable, you want to have an active cable, especially if you're trying to go over a length long as 2 meters. Anything basically over 18 inches, you're going to see degradation if you're not using an active cable with Thunderbolt 3. And oh, guess what? Active cables, if you have them, those are the ones that are not compatible with USB 3.1. So you cannot mix your active and passive cables between Thunderbolt 3 devices and USB 3.1 Type-C devices. And then finally, and this is the best part, it's the best part, and yes, I'm being sarcastic if you're not catching on to that, there seems to be no consistency or labeling standards to help you find or pick the right cable. There's not a little icon. There's not any other information. So when you buy a cable, again, consider marking it in some way with its properties. The type of cable that it is it Thunderbolt or USB-C? Is it active or is it passive? What's the amount of power rating that it has? What's the length of the cable? So I would buy some little cable ties or little cable labels. I found a couple of cool ones on Amazon and just attach those to your Thunderbolt and USB 3.1 Type-C cables so you know what they are. So in summary, to kind of hopefully demystify all of this, because I know I threw a lot of information at you, active Thunderbolt 3 cables are high speed, but they tend to be more expensive, and they will lack USB 3.1 Type-C compatibility. So you really want active Thunderbolt 3 cables just for your Thunderbolt devices. Passive Thunderbolt 3 cables are generally shorter, maybe up to 18 inches for best performance. If you want to go longer, though, you can do that. Just know that your performance is for Thunderbolt 3 throughput is going to degrade. But the advantage of a passive Thunderbolt 3 cable is that you could also use it for your USB 3.1 Type-C devices. So you can mix and match those. Next, just remember that no cables, whether they're passive or active, are going to tell you anything about their power rating, how much wattage they can be, you know, can be pushed through them, at least not on the cable themselves. So when you buy the cable, it should be on the packaging. You're going to want to make sure that you label and note what that is. And then finally, if you just need USB 3.1 compatibility, so if you know the thing that you're connecting is just a USB 3.1 device, don't get the more expensive passive Thunderbolt 3 cables. Just go with a standard USB 3.1 type cable. Again, knowing that you're not going to be able to use that cable interchangeably with your Thunderbolt devices. So, wow, I had really no idea. I thought USB Type-C, the connector, and Thunderbolt being part of that was going to simplify things. It totally hasn't. And I want to say a big thanks to Apple Insider for pointing this out, because I would have never known. And I know there's a lot of you out there that are getting new Macs with Thunderbolt 3 support and USB Type-C connectors. So I wanted to make sure that you were aware of it as well. If you have any comments on this, or if I've totally confused you and you have additional questions, of course, email me and I'll do my best to kind of help sort things out. All right, finally in the show for this week, I want to talk a little bit about AppleCare Plus Mathematics, doing math on AppleCare. And this comes up because it's a question I get asked very often, and I often ask myself, especially when I'm going to buy a new iPhone, which many of us are probably going to be doing in the next couple months. And that question is it worth it to buy AppleCare Plus on my iPhone? And especially if you know that you're going to replace your iPhone every year, because you do get 1 year of AppleCare, not AppleCare Plus, which adds the accidental damage protection, but you do get 1 year of AppleCare with your device. So that means if something breaks, you have an issue that's not user related, like not user damage or accidental damage, but just say out of the factory, some component fails or something like that, you're going to be covered under standard AppleCare for that. And Apple is going to repair or replace that, at least for the first year. So what AppleCare Plus adds really is the advantage of having accidental damage protection. And if you consider that the most common accidental damage is a cracked screen, then you need to start to do the math on whether or not AppleCare Plus is really worth it. And a lot of what goes into this is knowing yourself and knowing how you treat and use your iPhone. If you're the type of person that doesn't generally drop it, that maybe has had a cracked screen on occasion, this equation is going to work out very differently for you than if you're the type of person who's constantly dropping their phone, especially into water or getting water damage and those sorts of things. So here's a little bit of the math. Buying AppleCare Plus up front on a new iPhone 7 currently right now will run you $129 US. A cracked screen has an accidental damage replacement cost of $29 if you have AppleCare Plus. So that first incident is going to cost you $129 plus another $29. So overall, that's going to run you $158 if you crack the screen and you have AppleCare Plus. Now compare that to the out-of-warranty cost for a replacement screen on that same iPhone. That cost is $129. So for the first cracked screen, you're actually saving $29 by not purchasing AppleCare or AppleCare Plus. Now, other user damage to the phone, say things like water damage, that actually is a higher replacement cost or higher charge under AppleCare Plus. If you water damage your iPhone, it's going to cost you $99 under AppleCare Plus. So in that instance, if that's the type of damage, it's probably going to be a little bit more worth it. But remember that the iPhone 7 currently is pretty water resistant. It can withstand up to 30 minutes of submersion in up to 1 meter of water. So dropping it in the sink or worse in the toilet and having to fish it out, it's probably going to survive without any water damage. So is it worth it for the accidental damage protection? Again, it's going to depend on how frequently you damage your phone in the first 2 years of ownership, right? So if you're replacing it every year and you don't generally go through cracked screens, it may be worth it to opt out of the AppleCare Plus. And I hate to say that, but again, that's just the math. If you prefer having AppleCare Plus just because it gives you peace of mind, go ahead and buy it. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I'm just trying to give you information and thought on, you know, do a little bit of math and decide for yourself, is this really worth it? And if you're going to be keeping your phone longer than a year, it might also be worth it just for the added repair coverage in case a component fails or something like that. Having an extra year of coverage may be worth it. Now, I have to admit that I have iPhones going back all the way to an iPhone 5S in my family right now, and none of them have needed repairs beyond a extra battery, which is not covered under AppleCare. So I've had to do battery replacement, but really not had to do any screen replacements. Now, my iPhone 7, I did have a little bit of screen damage, and I did replace the screen one time, but I did also buy AppleCare Plus on it. So I'm still at a $29 deficit, and I'll be getting a new phone soon. So did it work out for me this time around? It really didn't. And that is likely why, for me, with my next iPhone, I probably will not be opting in for the AppleCare Plus. But again, that's just my choice. I'm just giving you information that will maybe help you make a more informed decision next time you're at the Apple Store buying a new iPhone and they ask you that question, would you like AppleCare Plus? So just something to think about. And again, I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions on this. If you agree with me, disagree with me, of course, send those in, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications and software by visiting smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I love your comments, your questions. Of course, the MacCast is a big community, so without you, this really wouldn't work. If you have something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, something you'd like me to talk about, send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-622-4269. MacIM9, and you're also always welcome to leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is the MacCast, and that's great if you want to save on long distance charges over the voicemail account. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can of course find those on the website. That's at maccast.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's a great place to ask questions of the MacCast community and get some great answers from some really knowledgeable people. There's a great little core group of people that hang out over on the MacCast forum. So if you haven't checked that out, be sure to do that. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.